matters?
That is correct, Orr said. He wondered briefly why Osprey had not requested a pricey Assemblies of Jehovah hack. Rhonda was young, bright, up for a stoush, but he didn't seem to have much at stake in the proceedings. Not bored, looking to have fun, if anything. His engagement more intellectual than emotional, in Orr's judgment. Maybe it was the look. An earring. Designer spectacles. Unshaven in the regrettable style made ubiquitous by the makers of TV commercials. Rundle seemed to read Orr's thoughts and gave a whisper of the shadow of a smile. "Mr. Osprey, why don't we begin with why you were at Mr. Lang's house?" Claire said. Osprey mulled on that, a grey-faced spectre on the other side of the table. "Will I go to jail?" "Quite possibly," Orr said. "You committed serious assaults on Mr. Lang and Ms. Sullivan, and hindered a murder investigation." "May I remind you why we're here?" Rundle said. "All right, we'll start at the beginning," Claire said. "Mr. Osprey, you're an elder of the Assemblies of whatever church?" Osprey said stiffly, "I'd rather you didn't mock my beliefs." Claire went on blithely. "A vehicle apparently stolen from your car yard was used in the commission of two murders. One of the victims, Mary Peart, being a young Assemblies Church member. Isn't that rather a coincidence?" "Ex-member." I said, "That's quite a coincidence." "The vehicle in question was stolen," Osprey said. "You're really going with that story," Orr said. Osprey flushed. "If you were trying to say I stole the car and then went and shot someone, then I'm refusing to say anything more." "Can you account for your movements back then?" He was triumphant. "I can, indeed." He glanced at Rundle, who opened a folder and retrieved an envelope. "My client had this in his pocket when he was processed earlier today." Orr was curious. "Well prepared? Expecting arrest?" "Why don't you give us the gist, Mr. Osprey?" "Receipts? Hospital paperwork? I had a cataract operation at the time the Suzuki was stolen. I couldn't drive anywhere. I was half blind for a few days. I didn't kill anyone. I would never do such a thing." The man was talking freely, so Orr pushed a little. "Mr. Osprey, were you coerced to do what you did today?" No answer, but the man shifted in his chair. "Did you fear it might all go pear-shaped?" No answer. "Mr. Osprey," Claire said, "I understand that you're a devoted member of the Assemblies of Jehovah congregation. Loyal, faithful, eager to do the right thing. But matters are coming to a head. I put it to you that you were asked to provide the leader of your church, Warren Hintz, with a vehicle that was subsequently used in a double homicide." Osprey sagged a little. He gave his lawyer an anguished look. Rundle's shrug was almost imperceptible. "Were there other crimes you were party to on behalf of Mr. Hintz? The sexual abuse of the children of your congregants, for example?" "What?" That straightened him up. "Not me. Never." "Then how do you explain today's actions?" Orr said. At a look from Rundle, he held up his hand. "My question refers to the hold these people seem to have over your client." "You can answer, Mr. Osprey," Rundle said, with a hint of enjoyment. He was curious too. "Were you asked or ordered or blackmailed in any way?" "We don't believe for a moment that you killed anyone, or knowingly provided the means," Orr said. "You didn't drive the vehicle, shoot the gun, hide the gun. But we do believe you know more than you're telling us." "Gun? What gun?" Orr was flat and hard. "The gun used to kill Mary Peart and probably her boyfriend was found hidden in the Suzuki stolen from your yard." Osprey blanched. He swallowed. Rundle looked at him with interest. Time passed. Orr, looking at the way Osprey chewed his bottom lip, thought they'd lost him. Then, "Warren Hintz came to me and said he needed to borrow a vehicle for a couple of days. I wasn't to ask why. It was church business. When he didn't return it, I asked for it back, and he said it had been stolen from him. He paid me the value of the vehicle, and I thought nothing of it." "But you reported it stolen to make it official." "Well, it was stolen. Warren borrowed it from me, then it was stolen from him before he could return it, the idiot. He gave a twist of his mouth. I hate to speak ill of the fellow, and I'm not saying he can't whip up a congregation, but really he wasn't all that bright. They watched him. All said, Mr. Osprey, were you asked to intimidate Carmen Sherlow? She said an older man, a business type, hassled her afterwards. A slight conceding shrug as Osprey looked down at his pale fingers. Not proud of it. Warren asked me to. Said if I wanted the money for the Suzuki, I had to do it. We need a statement, Mr. Osprey, and we must caution you in relation to this matter. Osprey was resigned now, almost relieved. Whatever it takes. I've had enough. The church is more or less bankrupt anyway, and why should I take all the blame? Claire looked at him and said very gently, Mr. Osprey, you have a daughter. Osprey's face changed, transformed by an expression of pure misery. You will not talk to me about that. Please don't talk to me about that. I'll help you with anything else you like, but I don't want her dragged into anything. Warren hints, thought all. And he's lived with it, unable to see, or, if he saw, to do anything about it. And it's pulled him apart. All right. Now, did Mr. Hintz say anything at all about why he needed the Suzuki? No. I just did as I was told. Did you later connect it to the murder of Mary Peart? I had no reason to. Not until you spoke to me the other day. And today? What was that all about? You were doing the Hintz's bidding again, destroying evidence for them. Osprey shook his head. It was all about the money. It was only ever about the money. All looked at Pascal. She looked back at him. Sighed. A tiny noise of fulfillment. All right, Mr. Osprey. Tell us about the money. Chapter 38. That was Saturday. As soon as they were back at Chateau Hall, Claire packed, kissed All on the cheek, gave him a bottle of good wine, and called for a taxi to take her home. The house seemed empty around him that night. Waking at 6 a.m. Sunday, All walked, bought croissants. Coffee, croissants, and the Sunday Age at the mossy wrought iron table in the backyard, dimly bathed in sunlight. Cynthia stretched on the sun-warmed crazy path. At 8, Liz appeared, freshly showered, overnight bag in her hand. Sorry, I'm meeting people for lunch in Queenscliff. I'd better rush. And she was gone. All blinked. He hadn't even known she'd stayed the night. Meeting people for lunch? Or meeting a special person? He realized it didn't matter so much anymore. Tried to tell himself that, anyway. Then Beck, half awake, grabbed a croissant and waved goodbye. I have to open the shop. Tanya lost her keys. She was always floating names at him. Friends, co-workers, people he'd forgotten meeting, or would never meet, or who too closely resembled one of the others. So he just smiled benignly. She kissed him and clattered along the hallway and out the door. It was time for All to move his weary bones. A nurse was arranged for Warren Hintz, while the wife and son were arrested and brought to the city for questioning. Separate cars, separate interview rooms. The first thing Judith Hintz said was, You do realize it's the Sabbath?
Means nothing to us, Mrs. Hintz,
Claire said. She looked subdued. The law never rests, All said. Speaking of which, you're entitled to a lawyer.
I don't need a lawyer, Judith Hintz said, and my son doesn't need a lawyer. We've done nothing wrong.
All and Pascal smiled noncommittally, settled her in one of the interview rooms with a uniform at the door, then conferred in the corridor. How do you want to play this? Claire asked. Adam first.
Agreed. He might be the dear leader, but his mother holds the reins.
They walked up to the next level. So how are things at home? They walked, Claire silent. Then,
if you must know, Michael lost it when I said I had to work today.
The case does have momentum,
all said. Except that the weekend is shot to hell. Well, you know, there's a room at my place.
Alan, I've barely started phase two of my marriage.
They found Adam fidgeting at an interview room table. Why am I here?
It's the Sabbath.
You know why you're here. You assaulted your wife. Also, you either committed or helped cover up two murders.
That's ridiculous.
Was it you or your mother who asked Mr. Osprey to find and destroy the house?
I don't know anything about that.
He said it was your mother. Adam shot each of them a blunt, frightened look. Seemed to see conviction on their faces.
All right, he said quickly. If you must know, it was me. I asked him. Mum had nothing to do with it.
What a loyal son you are, Claire said with her sweet smile.
How much did the guy know? All sharpened his voice. You asked him to destroy a house, yes?
Why?
Hintz hesitated.
To destroy evidence.
What evidence? Hintz frowned, concentrating.
Well, bloodstains.
DNA? Fingerprints?
Bullet holes in the
floor.
The walls.
And why might those things have been present?
Adam Hintz drew himself up onto surer ground.
A few years ago, when my father's mind was starting to go, he'd let slip that he'd done a terrible thing. Murdered Mary and Robert. It tormented his conscience. Then those Royal Commission allegations. It was the ruin of him. You saw him. He has dementia. He was a proud man, and to see him brought down, well, too late now, of course. You found the house. But I didn't want to see him diminished further in the eyes of the world, and that's why I asked Mr. Osprey to destroy the evidence.
Claire snorted.
You didn't even know about the house until 2 days ago.
The truth was under your nose the whole time, but you and your mother and your father treated Ruth like she barely existed.
I love my wife.
Claire brushed that aside.
To be clear for the tape, Mr. Hintz, you are admitting you've known for some years that your father was responsible for the murders of Mary Peart and Robert Sherlow in September 2009?
Yes.
You shot them both.
What?
No, my father did.
Inside the house they were living in at the time?
Yes.
And the three of you staged matters so that it appeared Robert was the killer?
Yes. I mean, no, my father did.
Drove Mary's body to a nature reserve and buried Robert under a slab?
Yes.
He told you all this?
Like I said, he confessed to my mother and me many years later. His mind was going and everyone was hounding us, and he had a bit of a breakdown and told us what he'd done.
With an expression of the profoundest indignation and regret, he added, I think the way he was treated tipped the balance into senility.
You didn't think to tell the police?
He's my father.
It's a hell of a big job, Orr said. Killing two people and staging a false scene. Driving a body all around the countryside. Are you sure he didn't have help? Claire Pascal leaned forward.
Adam, I put it to you that you helped your father carry out the killings and cover them up. What do you have to say in regard to that matter?
An absolute lie.
Big strapping bloke like you?
Surely you didn't let your father dig the hole?
Claire persisted.
I wasn't there.
Adam tried to fold his arms over his chest, but his bulk defeated him. It was all my father, I'm sorry to say. It devastated me. And my mother.
I expect it did, Orr said.
He cocked his head. According to the autopsies, two bullets hit Mary in the head and one in the chest, and Robert was shot once in the head and twice in the torso, with bullets from a Smith & Wesson .32 revolver. Adam nodded briskly.
That's right. My father showed us the gun. My mother said she didn't want it in the house and made me get rid of it.
Where?
Where no one can ever find or use it. Mixed into a concrete pour under a strip of shops we put up.
Hintz paused. I think my mother was scared Dad would shoot himself.
When police searched the house after Mary was found, they saw no evidence of blood or bullet holes. Your father must have done a good job cleaning up after himself.
Hintz shrugged.
He's a builder.
But then when Robert was found, we got worried that the police would use, new techniques. to find blood and so on.
So let's get the story sorted, all said. You were in love with Mary, hated it that she ran off with Robert, and shot them both.
What? No!
Hint snarled.
Aren't you even listening?
We have it on good authority that you were in love with her.
She was my friend.
We kind of grew up together after she came to live with us.
But she wanted someone else, right?
So you got rid of her, then married her sister.
Stop it!
Did your father love your wife in the way he loved Mary?
What do you mean? I don't...
Adam, said Claire Pascal, why did your father kill Mary? He glimpsed the angry scarring on her forearm and didn't take his eyes from it.
Punishment.
For what?
Hintz looked up.
Leaving the family of our church and living in sin, he said, as if this was the only conceivable reason.
Mary was the main target, and Robert was unlucky enough to be there when you shot her?
When my father shot her, yes.
But Mary had left the church several months earlier, Claire said. Why wait so long?
Dad wasn't certain where she was. All watched Hintz expressionlessly.
We have reason to believe that Mary left the church because she'd been sexually abused by your father.
It's possible she was also abused by the elders.
It's possible she was also abused by you.
If not for that, she might never have left.
That's a filthy lie! Hint spat the words. I would never do such a terrible thing. And my father loved his flock. He would never harm a soul.
Except for the small matter of a double murder, right? Anyway, he's gaga now, your father, Claire said lightly. Conveniently unable to account for his actions.
Hintz composed himself. My father is suffering some memory loss owing to his age. He's forgetful. He's not well. But he's a good, decent man, and the hounding he's received is unforgivable.
Unforgivable, Claire said.
Adam, let's try this question for size. Where would a young guy like you, a devout churchgoer, get hold of a Smith & Wesson revolver?
Hintz shook his head sadly.
There you go again. I played no part in my father's crimes. Where he got the revolver from, I have no idea. We do employ some quite rough men on our building sites from time to time.
Did you visit Mary?
I didn't know where she was living.
Didn't try to get her to come back to you? Or to the church?
No.
All said, did you own a car back then, Adam?
No.
So how did you get to the house to kill those poor young people?
My father. He drove there, by himself, in an assembly car. We have a lot of cars at our disposal.
Why didn't he simply burn down the house when he'd finished killing Mary and Robert?
He told me later that he wanted blame to fall on Robert. He was worried a fire would attract too much attention.
Ruth has made a statement, Adam. You know that, don't you? About the events of 10 years ago, and last Friday.
Hintz flushed. She shouldn't be dwelling on the past. Poor Ruth. Obviously, the discovery of Robert's body dredged up old memories. But she doesn't know anything.
No one bothered to involve her, did they? Claire said.
No one bothered to talk to her at all, really.
I guess she was just your servant, wasn't she? And sex toy.
Can she talk to me like that?
Hintz asked all.
He swung back to Claire. You can't talk to me about private family matters like that.
Christ, all thought. This Patsy. This soft young man enthralled to his bullying father and his crackpot faith. All the disasters that have befallen the assemblies. You must really be struggling financially.
Faintly perplexed, Adam Hintz said, with God's grace, we'll survive.
Still, all persisted, if a big bundle of cash had gone missing, you'd want to get it back. All those legal costs.
Adam Hintz looked puzzled. It wasn't an act. He didn't know what Osprey knew about the money.
We'll take a short break, all said.
Chapter 39. A long break, so they could question Judith Hintz. As they headed down the corridor to the second interview room, all said,
he doesn't know the real reason why his father killed those kids.
I agree.
He didn't know about the money in 2009, and doesn't know about it now.
After our visit on Friday, I'm betting Judith coached him in a story that made some kind of sense. Yes, Warren was to blame for everything, but they did have a duty to protect his name as much as possible. As to who exactly was... Claire's mobile chirped. She glanced at the screen, stopped dead in her tracks, and gave all a broad grin. Judith. Judith what? Fingerprint match. Judith handled the gun. She was there. Or she shoved it behind the dashboard of the Suzuki, at the very least. Yes! All barked. He clapped his hands, strode on again. Excellent. Judith Hintz was tidy, composed, but there was a tired sag beneath her eyes. All said, "You still don't want a lawyer, Mrs. Hintz? Surely the church can afford a good one." She laughed and it was derisive. "We're broke. It's all gone on legal fees." "Good," said All. "Straight to the main issue, the money." Judith Hintz went blank and tried to hold it.
"I have no idea what you're talking about.
All I know is I've done nothing wrong." "Put Ruth in hospital."
"How is the dear girl? When may I see her?"
"Probably 15 to 20, Claire said. "Meanwhile, in addition to hurting your son's wife, you are accessory to certain acts carried out by Mr. Rex Osprey yesterday." She shrugged.
"Mr. Osprey is quite capable of making his own decisions."
"And you also," All said, "murdered or helped cover up the murders of Robert Sherlow and Mary Peart." Her demeanor didn't alter.
"Don't be ridiculous.
That was a long time ago and had nothing to do with me. You took Mary Peart and her younger sister into your home when their parents were excommunicated, is that correct?"
"Yes."
Claire said, "Did your husband sexually abuse Mary?"
"Yes."
No flicker in the blank face. "Ruth?"
"Yes."
"Did your son abuse them?"
"No."
Angry now.
"And don't you try pinning it on him."
They were silent. All contemplated her, the hint of pink rising in her cheeks. Wondered if she'd had enough of the assembly and its menfolk. But the prints on the gun. "Mary met Robert Sherlow when he was hired to do gardening work and yard maintenance at your property in Emerald?"
"Yes."
"A relationship developed?"
"Yes. A friendship, really, at first."
"Did you disapprove?"
"Back then, yes. My husband disapproved, therefore I disapproved. Now I think, good luck to young lovers.
Except the luck didn't last for those two." "Are you fed up with the men who run your church, Mrs. Hintz? Is that it? Fed up with your husband's actions? The betrayal?"
He was a weak man."
"So, Robert and Mary, they became lovers and Mary ran away." The woman shrugged.
"Ran away from Warren or ran towards love? One or both?"
"She took Ruth with her."
"Poor girl. She came back the next day. But Mary always had more spunk."
"On Friday, you said Ruth didn't go to the house where Mary was living."
"I forgot. It wasn't important."
"Back when Mary was murdered, the media ran with the story that Robert was dealing drugs, and things got out of hand, and he murdered Mary and disappeared."
"Well, I think you know the real story," Judith Hintz said, in her abrupt get-on-with-it manner.
"It was Warren." "With the help, willing or otherwise, of your son," Claire Pascal said. "Were you there? Did you help?" The woman snarled.
"Adam had nothing to do with any of it. Nor did I. Not then, and only to a limited extent now. My husband shot both those youngsters. He was away for 2 days."
"Your son had nothing to do with it?"
"Correct."
"You had nothing to do with it?"
"Correct."
Everything was carefully staged. Mary's body was moved, Robert's was buried under a slab, the scene was cleaned up, there was misdirection. Is your husband capable of that kind of meticulousness?
He set up a successful church, didn't he? Ran a successful business? He's bright, and he's good with his hands.
Is he mentally competent?
No. The dementia is real. Talk to the doctors.
We will. When your husband returned from his 2 days away, he told you what he'd done?
Yes.
You didn't think to report it to the police at the time?
Of course not.
He just went off to kill Mary Peart for leaving the church, all said. And while he was about it, he also shot Robert Sherlow. And then he came back again and life went on as normal.
Correct.
But Adam just told us he knew nothing about any of it until some years later.
Correct. There are matters kept secret between husbands and wives. There was no need to trouble Adam. But then my husband's name was dragged through the mud and he kept wailing and gnashing his teeth and it all came out.
And what, it triggered senility?
She shrugged. Who knows?
Mrs. Hintz, are you able to explain why your fingerprints were found on the gun that was used to shoot Mary Peart? Chapter 40. Late afternoon now. Judith Hintz, sour and washed out in the interview room. This time she had a lawyer with her, a woman in her 50s, with sharp eyes and nervy fingers, who kept fidgeting as if she wanted to leap in with objections and warnings. My client has, since her earlier interview, decided to acknowledge that she helped her husband in the commission of the two murders. She did not fire the gun, but merely handled it. All said, well, that saves time and paperwork. Where did you get the gun?
Hintz said, I don't know where my husband got it. However, he was a builder. He's employed many men over the years from all kinds of backgrounds.
An echo of the interview with Adam. Okay. Explain why you placed it behind the dashboard of the Suzuki you borrowed from Mr. Osprey's yard. At the sound of Osprey's name, Judith Hintz looked uneasy. She said,
we were on our way back and saw a booze bus, and in a panic I hid the gun. Then we had to stop for petrol, and that's when someone stole the car. I couldn't believe it.
Very well. So you helped your husband commit two murders?
Yes. I'm not proud of it. In fact, I didn't even know he intended to do it.
He asked you to accompany him to the house where Mary was living with her boyfriend?
Yes.
Did he say why?
To ask Mary to reconsider.
And what, she refused? Things got rough?
Yes.
Your husband thought he could persuade Mary with a gun?
The gun was for protection. Robert was young and he was tough, and he was a nasty little shit. Excuse the language.
Robert was mild-tempered and physically small, from all accounts. I put it to you that you went with your husband with the intention of punishing Mary for leaving the fold, and punishing Robert for luring her away. Hintz flared at him. So what? It wasn't my idea. It was Warren's. He was always banging on about the need to punish disobedience. Claire Pascal said, that's quite a ring you've got there. Judith Hintz had been worrying the ring. Now she went very still. She turned to her lawyer.
I do not intend to answer any more questions. If asked questions, I will simply answer no comment.
You're suddenly a bit touchy, Judith. I wonder if it's because you ripped that ring off Mary's finger.
No comment.
Judith Hintz's lawyer smiled. Her hands were quiet now. Back to the bewildered wreck of Adam Hintz, sitting two doors away from his mother. Staring at the great lump of a boy opposite him, all said, we've been puzzled about a certain injury to one of Mary Peart's fingers. Adam Hintz's gaze flicked about the room. He's trying to guess what his mother said, all thought. It must have happened when Dad moved her. We think a finger was broken when this was forcibly removed, Claire Pascal said, placing Judith Hintz's ring at the center of the table. Hintz stared at it in confusion. Don't know what you mean. All said, you maintain that your father went to the house where Mary and Robert were living and shot Mary for running away from the church. Yes, for the 100th time. It was time to haul out Rex Osprey's story. I put it to you that your parents went to the house to get back several $100,000, plus quite a bit of your mother's jewelry. Adam Hintz shook his head wildly. He was halfway capable of accepting that his father had killed in order to punish. There was a nice Old Testament ring to that. Nothing righteous about murder for money, though. Don't know what you mean. We know that your father had amassed a huge sum from donations. Very little of it benefited the church. He was keeping it for himself, fearful the church would lose its tax-exempt status. For years there had been rumbling, people speaking out, calling the Assemblies of Jehovah a sham. Not a sham. He stowed that cash and your mother's jewelry in a safe in his study. Mary knew about the safe. She knew the combination. Your father had probably scribbled it on a slip of paper, which he stuck under the desk. Perhaps she saw it when he was raping her on the floor one day. She told Robert about the abuse. She told Robert about the money. Sometime in September, they sneaked back and robbed the safe. Call it revenge. Call it greed, if you like. They were also getting ready to leave the state and tried again to get Ruth to accompany them. She said no. It's possible she told your father. Or he saw them on the property. It doesn't matter. He soon worked out who'd robbed him, and he went after them with the direct help of your mother and the indirect help of Rex Ospreay. Hints was lost. My mother can't have told you these lies. It was Mr. Ospreay. He's a liar, trying to save his own skin. They went to the house, but all they got was that ring, which your charming mother tore off Mary's finger. It must have been a chaotic situation. A gun waved around, a struggle, with the result that Mary and Robert were shot before your darling parents got the money back. Pascal added, he was an impatient man, wasn't he, your father? Aggressive? The kind of go in swinging? But it all went badly wrong, and suddenly Mary and Robert were dead and he still didn't know where the money was hidden. Hintz rolled his shoulders, but all could see that the scenario made sense to him. He could visualize it. Pascal went on. All your parents found was the ring on Mary's finger. Robert was restoring the house, remember? Perhaps there were a couple of floorboards still loose, so he stowed the money under them while he and Mary got ready to leave. Of course, an honest person would have gone to the police, all said. But your father wasn't honest. He didn't want reporters, or the tax office, or the elders, to know he was squirreling money away. Later on, he thought it through and went back to search the house, Pascal said. But by then it was gone, and he had no luck finding anyone connected to Mary or Robert who might have the money. You people really should have paid more attention to Ruth. All couldn't help himself. Hintz tried to rally. If what you're saying is correct, that money's rightfully ours. Good luck with that, Claire said. We'll find it long before you lot get your grubby little hands on it. I expect it would come in handy about now, all said. Barrister's fees, victims demanding compensation, not to mention ordinary greed. My father has dementia. He's not liable. Your father is a rapist, said Claire. Adam Hintz drew himself up. Either way, it was my father who did those murders. Not me. Not my mother. We have the gun, Adam, Claire said. Hintz said warily, so what? Your mother's prints are on it. She was there. Pulled the trigger for all we know. Or all three of you were there. Judith had said not, though, and the mix of emotions on Adam Hintz's face bore that out. Not really all that bright, your father, all said. Your mother knew she couldn't trust him to get it right. Hintz looked like a man realizing he was now truly alone. She would never hurt anyone. Ben all felt his phone vibrate in his pocket, fished it out, saw the number for the crime scene manager, excused himself, and took the call in the corridor. About the house in Skye? Queried the technician. We're wondering if we were properly briefed. All said patiently, we're hoping you'll find evidence of a double homicide, plus cash and jewelry concealed under the floorboards or inside the walls. But just then, all felt a prickle of, what? Not alarm, anticipation. The feeling opening like a late flower as the forensics guy said, but someone's already searched the place. Floorboards prized up, he told all. A wall panel removed. Chapter 41. They were finished by mid-afternoon. Charges laid. All dragged himself onto a Swanston Street tram. The weekend's adrenaline rush depleted. Thinking now only of Neve Fanning lying in hospital. peer fanning in fear of the prospect of living with her father. Lang with his broken jaw, his home a crime scene. Not wanting to return to an empty house, he wandered down to the private gallery in Rothdown Street. "Just looking," he said. But before he quite realized it, he was buying a little Charles Blackman drawing of a schoolgirl. Was it a treat? A reward? He left the gallery faintly dazed, with a feeling that his Sunday was filling up strangely, and almost immediately experienced an odd echo of the case just closed. A poster on a side wall. Rock concerts, experimental theatre, pub gigs and lost dogs. And a word catching his eye. Assemble. It was a flyer for a march on Parliament. But all saw only Rex Osprey and the deluded neophytes of the Assemblies of Jehovah International. He called Claire Pascal. "Fancy a trip to Frankston tomorrow?" "Sorry, got some patching up to do." So all made the trip alone on Monday, an Uber delivering him to the public hospital by 10 a.m. He asked for Lang's room and was directed to a small ward. Lang still looked dazed, but recognized him and cast a reassuring look at the young woman with him, who proved to be the daughter. After the introductions, all said, "Mr. Lang, did anyone visit you in the last couple of days? A stranger?" Lang nodded. "Scouting trip," thought all. "Did this person give a name?" Lang gestured at his daughter, turning his wrist in a circle, and she reached for a notepad and pen on the bedside table. He wrote, printing the words neatly, "Can't remember." "Can you give me a description?" "Woman, about 30. A bit alternative. Tattoos of birds on neck." All smiled. "Did she say what she wanted?" "Her brother used to live in my house. Dead now. She just wanted to see it." "I bet," thought all. "Did she say how she found you?" "Phoned house removalists." As I should have done, all thought, if it had occurred to me that the house was still intact. All didn't know how many tens of thousands of dollars Robert Sherlow had stashed in the old house, but he must have told his sister Carmen about it. All didn't think any of it was rightfully the property of the Hintz family, and it shouldn't become the property of the state government, or languish in a police evidence safe. But nor should Carmen keep it all. He climbed into the car and phoned her hotel. She checked out. He texted her, "Mary's sister Ruth should get half." He didn't expect a reply, but around the Ringwood off-ramp his phone pinged. "You think?" Feeling a little buoyed, all sat back and smiled. Carmen might have been having fun with him, of course, but he sensed he'd got her thinking. He decided to give her the benefit of the doubt. Chapter 42. Now it was early November. Melbourne Cup Day came and went. The spring sun grew stronger, gearing up for summer. And all the world, including retail, knew Christmas was approaching fast. Helen Colfax's detectives took on new cold cases and wrapped up or put on hold current ones. The Hintzes and Osprey were the responsibility of the OPP now. Sometimes all happened to encounter Jerry Debenham in the police building and received the narrow-gazed treatment that said, "I still don't trust you." But Colfax said Debenham treated everyone that way, and meanwhile Janine Neal's toxicology results had come back. Hypoglycemic seizure. The theory being that Alec Neal had fed his non-diabetic wife a high dose of some glucose-lowering drug. Pia Fanning still had her leg in a cast, but was recovering quickly. All phoned her regularly, and flew to Adelaide for a couple of days every fortnight or so. He'd sit quietly watching Neve, or trying to talk her out of her coma, before heading to the Deans' rented apartment where he'd read to Pia, chat, kid around. He didn't encounter Lloyd Fanning, but apparently he'd called in to see his daughter, not his wife. Pia said, "If I'm better at Christmas, he wants to take me to Bali for the whole of the holidays." All cocked his head to read her. She was getting good at flat expressions. "You don't want to go," I want to be here in case Mum wakes up.
Tell him that.
He doesn't listen.
Pause.
I have to go and live with him when I'm better, don't I?
I won't lie to you. Yes.
New school, new everything,
Pia said, her eyes filling. When your mum's better and her lawyer can swing into action, it's possible you won't have to live with him permanently.
That's not what he says. He says she's going to jail. He says I'm his forever.
Then on a Friday in December, Orr let himself into Chateau Orr, dumped his keys, wallet and jacket, and dodged around Cynthia's sinuous greeting, and found Beck in the kitchen. She'd just got home from work, her gewgaws t-shirt wrinkled, damp with perspiration.
A woman called a minute ago.
All stiffened whenever he heard these words. He'd think, the hospital. But usually it was a witness, a colleague. Who was she? A short wait while Beck gulped down a glass of water, and gasped and swiped her hand across her mouth.
She said she was from Pia's school. She wants a word with you.
Concerning?
She was a bit close-mouthed, Dad, but I said you'd be home about now. Is that okay?
With a twirl of her fingers, Beck pounded up the stairs. Orr glanced at his watch. 5:30 p.m. He wanted a beer, but would that give the wrong impression? He sat in his favourite chair instead and coaxed Cynthia onto his lap. Answered the knock when it came, finding a young woman on his front step. Broad shoulders, short hair. Wary, yet apologetic, and tentative too. As if she wasn't sure of all. Wasn't sure of herself.
Are you Mr. All?
I am.
Mrs. Neve Fanning and her daughter Pia lived here until recently?
They did. She chewed at her bottom lip.
Pia told me about you. She said you were a policeman.
Yes, I am. Further doubt and reluctance. The woman assessing him. A practical figure in a flowery skirt and plain t-shirt. A slim document wallet under her arm. Not ready to enter his house yet. All said, you know my name, but I don't know yours, or how you relate to Pia. She nodded abruptly, shot out her hand.
Tina Acton, school counsellor.
Pia's school here in Carlton?
Yes, that's right.
All gestured. Let's continue this inside. But Acton was still not ready to move.
Is Pia here?
She and her mother are still in Adelaide. Acton closed her eyes, took a breath, and stepped past all into the hallway. Then she stopped and he collided with her.
Sorry, but I need to know, were you and Mrs. Fanning,
romantically involved? No, said all. Please, come in. He took Acton through to the sitting room. Tea? Coffee? Something stronger? Acton shook her head.
Water, please.
Water was fetched, and when they were seated and the cat had made itself comfortable in Acton's lap, Acton recoiling a little, all said, does this concern something Pia said or did? Something you noticed?
You're police, right?
Yes. A slow, troubled nod. Acton began to pat Cynthia.
Well, the police might need to be involved.
She darted him a look. Get on with it, he thought.
A couple of days before, Mrs. Fanning came and, took Pia out of school and, didn't bring her back. I gave a talk to the Year 6 kids about appropriate adult behaviour.
She stopped, took a breath, carried on.
Pia came up to me afterwards and said her dad sometimes touched her in ways that made her feel uncomfortable.
She stopped, as if afraid she'd said too much. All knew at once the reason for Acton's hesitancy. Mandated to report Pia's claim, she'd either failed to do it, or she'd acted too late. He said harshly, "Spit it out!" Acton gave him a pained, twisted smile and said,
"He told Pia it was their special secret. She shouldn't tell anyone."
"She told you."
Some kids find it easier to confide in someone less close, especially in the early stages.
Or let his fury show. Cut to the chase, Tina. Did you or didn't you report it?
Look, I'm really sorry. I have now, and I didn't mean to leave it so long, but I'm new in this job, and I needed to be absolutely sure, and then, you know, everything seemed to happen at once.
Did you tell Mrs. Fanning? I whispered.
Yes.
When?
The day before she ran off with Pia.
What exactly did you tell her?
I told her what Pia told me.
And what did she say? I need to know. Stop farting around.
Acton hunched her shoulders and the words came in a flood. She said she had doubts. She was beating herself up over it. She said one night she saw her husband leaning over Pia in bed, touching himself, and she once heard Pia say, "You're my special pussy," in her sleep. And apparently last Christmas Pia tongue-kissed one of Neve's brothers when he gave her a present.
Acton rocked in distress.
I wish I'd done something sooner. This is all on me.
All wasn't going to absolve her.
He idly wondered how the single expert, Kelso, would have responded if Neve had related the special pussy incident. Asked if she liked cats.
Will you attest to this in court? Will you make a statement?
Oh, God, yes, Acton said, as though let off the hook. Absolutely.
She left. All returned to the sitting room, too agitated to sit still. Stepped into the kitchen and poured himself a shaky glass of wine. And suddenly Beck was there, curious, sensitive to the moods of the house and her father.
What does she want?
All told her. Then they sat together at the table and finished the bottle, Beck spitting rage. He should do something, tell someone. Pia wouldn't be able to stay with her grandparents forever. Soon her father would have a clear shot at her. All was not heated. He felt icy cold as he traced the next steps in his mind. Report Lloyd Fanning to the Sex Crimes Unit at St Kilda Road. They would refer him to the Sexual Offences and Child Abuse Investigation Team in Geelong. Their investigation would drag, given that two essential witnesses were presently in South Australia, one in a coma. And Lloyd Fanning would call in his lawyer, who would refer the SOCIT officers to Neve's behaviour. Abducting his daughter from his house one weekend, with the help of a policeman, mind you. Abducting his daughter from school, stealing a car, trashing his house. A woman capable of all that would also be capable of putting ideas in her daughter's head. Talk to the eminent psychiatrist, Kelso. He knew exactly what Neve Fanning was like. All was cold, but that didn't stop the recriminations. He should have suspected earlier. Seen something. Pressed Neve. Her damned politeness and modest expectations and fear. Had she harbored suspicions but buried them? Hadn't let herself think the man she married would do that to their daughter? All flew to Adelaide on Boxing Day with a bike, which Pia accepted wanly. Her father's present, a card from Bali containing $50. Then All took them all to visit Neve, responding well to physical stimulation, according to the specialist, eyes fluttering, her arm jerking away if poked or squeezed. Could wake from the coma any day. Pia hugged All when he left, asked after Beck and Cynthia, and nodded politely when he told her there'd always be a bed for her if she visited Melbourne. All liked Melbourne in January. Less inner city foot and car traffic. Less noise. Fewer toxins to starve the eucalyptus and garden flowers. A sense that strangers might even smile if they encountered you walking at the end of a long, unrushed day.
Meanwhile, life goes on, Helen Colfax said.
She tapped a sheaf of papers together.
Are you growing a beard?
Trying to, All said, fingering the wiry, itchy clumps of silvery growth. The office was quiet. Josh Bug on holidays until late January, Claire Pascal and her husband in Sydney. As for Colfax, she liked to leave work early and head for the beach. Brown arms, brown neck, showing beneath a plain T-shirt today. Red nose and frizzy hair. Rubbing cream into the backs of her hands when All sauntered in to ask for time off. Asking about his beard was a way for her to gather her thoughts.
Time off, you say?
Just a few days.
You've only been here 9 months. True. Then again, our cases are cold. Almost frigid. She gave him a week.
Chapter 43. Bali was humid and overcrowded. The only decent accommodation all could find was a rundown hotel near the airport. But it didn't matter. He was not holidaying. Early the next morning, he hired a taxi, giving the driver an address he'd found in the handbag in the bedside table of Neve Fanning's hospital room. The taxi took him northwest, hills in the distance, the towns giving way to roadside shanties, paddy fields behind them on either side. Whenever the taxi pulled up at stop signs, kids flocked to All's window, offering cling-wrapped copies of Newsweek, The Straits Times, the International Herald Tribune, and other newspapers and magazines. Taking pot luck, All bought a November 2016 issue of the Melbourne Age. "Huh," he told the driver. "Donald Trump's been elected president of the US. The driver grinned and accelerated past a brightly decorated three-wheeled taxi. All placed the newspaper on the seat beside him and closed his eyes briefly. Then the taxi was climbing into the hills. The road was narrow, busy with small Japanese and Korean cars heading down to the main road. All wondered, what came first, narrow roads or narrow cars? They reached a handful of shanties, and, realizing he hadn't eaten, All asked the driver to stop behind an old man pushing a cart. He bought dumplings, an unleavened bread parcel, and a bottle of water. He offered the taxi driver a dumpling. The driver shook his head. A short distance away, downslope of the cart, a man was washing animal entrails in a ditch. All asked the taxi driver about it. "Is goat," said the driver. "Before to welcome new child." They drove on, past the shanties to more paddy fields, new rice shoots and still ponds, water rushing along the drainage ditches, a couple of large family compounds at the far end. Soon they reached the outskirts of a town in the folds of the coastal range, the driver slowing, saying, "Their house," and pointing to a villa upslope of the coast road, at the highest edge of a village. But as the driver began to accelerate, All spotted a walled compound, a sign on the gate reading, "Lotus Flower Yoga Retreat." He asked the driver to stop, paid the man the fare and a hefty tip, and got out. The retreat was an upmarket place, a huge house set deep inside a terraced garden. A security guard dressed in black with white armbands in a booth beside the front gate. The signs were in English, French, and German. All nodded to the guard, who seemed unsurprised to see a Westerner arrive so early, and he walked in as if he was known, expected, welcome. It was not his destination. It was a shortcut and useful cover. He walked around the side of the villa to where the rear wall looked onto the village and found a back gate. Another guard, equally unsurprised. All left the grounds and continued to climb towards Lloyd Fanning's house. Paddy fields to his right, haphazard little streets on his left. Small houses, shuttered shops, walled villas with family temples shaded by coconut palms. All reached the road leading to Fanning's villa. More small houses, a school, and a small mosque. Not many of these in Bali, All thought. It was a modest building, white, with a tiled roof, two green domes, and ornate mosaic work around doors and windows. But mostly All was interested in the villa. It overlooked the mosque from halfway up a slope. To reach it, All ran, doubled over, across the road to the surrounding wall. Concealed now, he skirted the building, making his way to the paddy system above. Finding a grove of trees on a bank, he sat where he couldn't be seen. Families were stirring in a couple of nearby houses, and from his vantage point, All saw hens pecking about, a goat straining its leash, TV sets flickering. Palm fronds whispered and chattered. Far-off motorcycles stuttered. A coconut fell onto a roof. All waited through the morning, as massive cloud banks adorned with strange horizontal rainbow bands gathered in the west. There were no signs of life in Fanning's villa until mid-morning, when a woman arrived accompanied by a small child. She let herself in, emerged later to shake out a broom, later again to toss soapy water onto the garden. Lloyd Fanning finally appeared late morning, sporting a bad case of bed hair, bum-crack pajama pants, and a vast white belly. He glared at the view, went inside, and re-emerged later with damp hair, combed, and wearing shorts and a t-shirt. He sat at his veranda table with a laptop. When the woman brought him a tray of food, he ignored her. The hours passed. Mid-afternoon, a man arrived with a machete, hacked at some dead palm fronds, left again. The woman departed with her child. All stirred to move, but a taxi appeared in the street below, turning up Fanning's driveway. Fanning stepped out of the house wearing trousers and a short-sleeved Hawaiian shirt. As if the driver were deaf, he shouted, "You take me Apache Underground? Kuta?" When they were gone, all hurried down to the main road and hailed a taxi to his hotel, where he showered and changed. Early evening now, he took another taxi, this time to Kuta Beach. It was a place of young Balinese men lounging, in doorways, on little Hondas, and Western families strolling, their daughters scuffing along in scraps of flimsy cotton, cars and mopeds crawling and tooting. All found Apache Underground opposite the Discovery shopping mall and saw Fanning at a table with three other men. They were just leaving. He went back outside and waited, followed Fanning and his companions when they emerged, noting the way they crowded the footpath, peering drunkenly at restaurant menu boards. He drew nearer, unrecognized in a floppy hat, sunglasses, and his new beard, as the men came to a decision. Heard one man say, "This place suit you guys?" And another say, "Good as any." The Sambal Beach Club restaurant was above a shop selling bootleg DVDs. All waited for 15 minutes, occasionally glancing up. Dim lights, discordant music, silhouetted people. He checked the time, 7:45, and climbed the stairs. Found himself in a large space overlooking the beach, with a scattering of dining tables, the bar a U-shaped island in the center. Fanning and his friends were at a table on the other side of the bar. All hesitated. On his side of the bar, there were tourists on stools. A single empty stool next to a woman wearing a thin cotton dress. That seat would give him a clear line of sight to Fanning. He found himself saying, "May I?" She flashed him a tired smile. He settled beside her and ordered a beer, cast the occasional glance Fanning's way. Silhouetted against an extravagant sunset, the four men were tucking into Nasi Goreng and Tiger Beer. Nothing distinctive about them. None of them young, all wearing the middle-aged holiday uniform of loose shirts and cargo pants. All guessed they had known each other for a while. Fanning had been coming to Bali for years. Maybe the others had too. Maybe they lived here. He felt uneasy suddenly. What if other bar patrons were interested in Fanning and his fellow diners? Australian Federal Police, for example. He ran his gaze over the room. A handful of tourists, muted lighting, murmured voices. Too early for the dance music, or the wasted 20-somethings from Melbourne, Auckland, Berlin, Los Angeles. Just then Fanning raised his head, as if feeling the force of all scrutiny, and all immediately turned towards the woman beside him. "Can I buy you a drink?" She had been fiddling with her iPhone, fiddling and muttering. "You can tell me why my phone's frozen, that's what you can do." Australian. Slightly unfocused. Not looking especially happy. Strong bony hands and tanned arms. Shoulders and thighs in a sleeveless dress. She leaned towards all and peered at him. She was pretty. Slightly sloshed. More friendly than wary. And he thought, perfect cover. Fanning, glimpsed from the corner of All's eye, had returned to his meal.